Hi everyone, I'm Justin Chisholm and you're listening to the Yacht Racing Podcast. My guest this time is the hugely accomplished American yachtsman Terry Hutchinson, skipper of the New York Yacht Club's American Magic Syndicate, which is challenging for the 36th America's Cup. Terry's last appearance on the podcast was back in January of 2019, long before the coronavirus pandemic turned the world upside down. Since then, the American Syndicate has had to think fast and adapt quickly. And as you'll hear on the interview, with their second AC-75 nearing completion up in Rhode Island, the team is already in the process of moving its whole operation down to Auckland, New Zealand, in order to be the first of the challengers to get precious on-the-water experience of the five possible race courses out on the Hauraki Gulf. It's a great interview that I think you're really going to enjoy, so let's get to it. So Terry Hutchinson, welcome back to the Yacht Racing Podcast. You're the first of our guests to make a return appearance. It was January 2019. I had to look in the diary when we last spoke. And back then, we were talking about what it was like to sail an AC-75 and the campaign, and it was all very fresh and new and exciting. And neither of us had any idea that 12 months later, pandemic that we're going through now would just turn the world upside down and I'm sure have a major impact on your campaign. So I wanted to start by just asking you, you know, can you kind of take us back to that time when you first kind of got wind of the pandemic and began to realize that it was going to have an impact on the campaign?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because American Magic, we actually made a request to the arbitration panel to ask for permission to stand down from going to Cagliari because we felt that it was going to put our teammates and really put us in a compromised spot with our health. And from there, as you can imagine, those things, without going into the detail, that was met with some resistance, and then inevitably common sense played out, and we had, I would commend the arbitration panel actually for how they handled it and how we navigated through all that. You know, it's something that none of the teams had ever experienced. But I would say that I thought that we certainly led that side of it. And since then, you know, it's an interesting time and an interesting place that we live in. You know, we worked after that. Once we knew we weren't going to go, we took a week off because the team had been going at a pretty feverish pace since the beginning of January, trying to get as many sailing days on the water. And really, we'd spent the whole last month of February in our race training configuration and learning what that meant and what that was going to feel like. And, so after we got back the last week of March and really all of April, we positioned ourselves to go sailing and made a week-to-week evaluation with the principals and with Commodore Lotz from the New York Yacht Club to make sure that first, whatever we did, we weren't going to endanger the community that we're living in. You know, we needed to be responsible citizens of Pensacola, and secondly, to make sure that we weren't going to put the team in an unnecessary position of risk. And in retrospect, seeing as it's the year of 2020 and we'll win them all in hindsight, it only feels a bit uneasy because we know we gave time back. As it would be that month of April and certainly the first part of May were probably the best 5 weeks that you could have had sailing in Pensacola. You know, it's just beautiful conditions, and sometimes the Lord works in mysterious ways. So I think it was just a great reminder how nice the sailing venue is in Pensacola. And at that point, we got to a spot where, you know, our future is in New Zealand, the events in New Zealand. And so we've taken an aggressive decision, but a necessary one, because we're stuck in a rock and a hard place in the United States. We can't sail in Pensacola Bay after May 31st because of hurricane season and our inability to get insurance. So if you just look at it and take it on the head right then and there, knowing that from the time we stop the sailing operation until the time we build another one back up, it's at a minimum 6 weeks. But at the time we're making these decisions, can't sail in Rhode Island, can't sail in California, can't really do anything. You're just in a massive holding pattern. And so it just felt prudent to, knowing that we were going to have to go on a ship at a certain point anyway, it just feels prudent. Well, we might as well, you know, we might as well go where we need to. And, you know, at that point, rely on really the leadership of the New Zealand government, who's shown, you know, really solid decision-making all the way through, to lead, you know, potentially the world and at least the America's Cup out of the backside of this. So that's where we are sitting here today. I mean, it's so difficult to make a consistent decision with the information that you have at hand, because the information's changing almost hourly. Yeah. But the things that we did know, you know, it was an absolute clanger what's happened in some of the major U.S. cities in the United States. I mean, you know, there's a lot of population and it's difficult to, you don't want to overwhelm the health system. And so, you know, I can live with the fact that we followed a bit of common sense, kept ourselves safe, we kept the Pensacola community safe. We've had, you know, to this day, we've had a lot of time on the water between the AC-75 and the Mule. So, you know, I think the measure of our team is going to be to see how we pick up, you know, if we pick up right where we left off, which I personally am confident we will, because, you know, we have a really good squad of people and everybody knows, everybody's motivated. There's not going to be a lack of motivation. And so I think, you know, the other side of our challenge, once we do start up again in New Zealand, will be taming the beast, making sure that we don't try to king hit it straight out of the box, that we, you know, again, apply a little bit of flat line to it and keep our eye on the prize in March.
I'm interested whether the three team principals that you refer to, these are all people who are, you know, captains of industry. They run enormous organizations of their own. What did they tell you about this? Because they must have had some really valuable insight into, you know, help you make decisions.
Yes, without question. And really in such an uncertain time, I'm normally not shy to follow a trajectory, certainly when we're racing, but here I was at a loss a little bit of what to do and not allow ambition to get in the way of common sense, which, you know, I can easily do that.
Yeah.
So between Roger and Doug and Hap and Commodore Lotz, you know, the reason we went week to week was because it was evolving and the situation was quite dynamic and changing. So we kept ourselves in a ready to sail state and allowed their leadership to flourish. And I mean, I say allowed, you know, they're heavily invested in what we're doing. And so, you know, the beauty of Roger and Doug in particular, you know, the DeVos's own, the Orlando Magic. And so we had a, you know, a professional league, the NBA, indirectly, you know, setting a trajectory. And then obviously with the NASCAR and with the Indy racing and all the auto racing going around the country, there's another dynamic there. And both disciplines are completely different. And in actuality, we're probably closer to the car racing than we are the basketball, because we don't really have, we were operating inside a custom secure port. There was no public access to us. And so we were reasonably comfortable that we were going to maintain a safe working environment. You know, our biggest risk was probably going to the publics.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, those guys were very, very good and very proactive in the decision making. And I would say probably, not probably, but they helped prevent us making a ambitious decision and understanding the consequence that if somebody got sick and, you know, the knock-on effect of that, that could be catastrophic. Sitting here, you don't like it because, sitting here, you like the decision because we stayed safe and kept everybody healthy. You just don't like the fact that we haven't been sailing, and that's driving everybody absolutely crazy. So
if you haven't been sailing, have you been hitting the simulator? Have you been racking up the hours on the simulator?
Yeah. I mean, that's the positive to all of it is there were always going to be deadlines. Dean and Anderson and Andrew and Goody, they've been, we've all been doing the simulator stuff. I've been back in Maryland now for a couple weeks. So, but prior to leaving, Pensacola, we were doing a lot of tube boating and stuff like that. And so there is ongoing work. There are ongoing deadlines that we have to meet. And so we, you know, we were taking that on, and the guys are working through, you know, foils that are being developed for February, March of next year. And, you know, all the things that have to happen, you know, probably the most positive side of our, the shining star of our team and our operation thus far has been the boat building side and the production facility in Bristol. You know, you can't say enough about how good of a job those guys have done at staying on track, following the guidelines and the hurdles that we had to go through to get to keep the facility up and going and to keep Boat 2 on track. And so, you know, everything has a silver lining, and for sure not having the distractions of two regattas and the logistical challenges that we were going to face there, not interfering with the development of foils and that side of it, that's been an absolute bonus.
I was going to ask you about that. Has there been any downside to not doing those events? Because it would have been a chance for you to line up against the other teams for sure.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the inherent downside is, you know, what you just rightfully pointed out, not, you know, the opportunity not to see what we were up against. I mean, two teams had very similar concepts and hulls, and two teams, you know, were completely different. And so you would have loved to have seen how that all crossed over. You know, all four teams have different ideas and foils, and you would have loved to seen how that crossed over. And then obviously the sail development and the aero development, but behind the scenes, then there's the measurement and there's all the things that go into going racing. And we're all inexperienced at that. We're all completely novices, and you know, we have some great, there's a lot of experienced people in developing this stuff, but this is the world's most complicated monohull. And so, you know, regardless of how much experience you have, it doesn't change the fact that it's hard.
Yeah. I feel like you must have been reading my questions, and I know you haven't been, because I wrote them only an hour or so ago, but you're picking up exactly the points. I mean, you know, how hard are these boats to race? You know, the World Series stuff. But one of the questions I'm going to come on to this, because you mentioned one thing a few seconds ago, and it was that you were doing two boat training, and I think you meant on the simulator.
Yes,
is that right? So tell me how that works, because that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting, because when you go out and the month of February, we would position the boat, we'd go, you know, we'd work on all our timings, and you know, it all sounds pretty basic and easy, but with a boat that's reasonably unstable, you have to be smart about how you position it, and you know, you can't just wing it. So you got to be a bit pragmatic there. And then you have, because we don't really know the boundary widths and we don't have a lot of insight into what the racing's going to look like yet. You experiment with the boundary sizes and the course lengths, and you know, you really understand how many maneuvers and, you know, all the idiosyncrasies that it's going to take to race the boat well. And I can see that, you know, depending on some of the nuances that get thrown at us with course sizes and boundary widths and all those things, you know, it's going to be, it'll change the dynamic of the racing quite a bit. It also changes the dynamic of the type of boat and the type of foils you have. So, you know, it's this whole new world of development, of which we'd never have done in a TP52 or an IACC class boat, or you know, anything really. And so now some of the other teams, you know, I have limited experience in simulation development, so in that regard it's very cool to learn and develop a playbook based off of computer simulation.
Yeah.
And then you go out on the water and you do it by yourself, and you know, very quickly it's like, okay, well, you know, you can draw the lines to exactly where you are, and you know, even as we were doing it by ourselves, you would hear in the comms, you'd hear Dean talking about, okay, we're going to do this. You know, this is what we're doing here. And, you know, when you go and you, you know, when you truly look at it, so we're going to have, you know, before the start of the Challenger selection series, the way the schedule is right now, we'll have 4 days of racing before we have to go and get into it for earnest. And so, yeah, that's not, I mean, that's not easy. And then you think about it in, as the defender. So the defender will have 4 days of racing and then they'll be sitting there watching us.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that was something as I was writing the questions today, I just suddenly realized, wow, they're, you know, compared to last time when they got a lot of time against the challenges, they're really going to be limited to a tiny amount.
And how impressive was it to see the development that took place through that Challenger selection series?
Yeah.
And how much better the boats were in the Louis Vuitton final than they were even during the round robins.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you can chalk probably a lot of that result up to Team New Zealand getting their absolute win range perfect. I mean, you couldn't have asked for, you know, I know in the communications that I've had with Daltz, I mean, he chuckles because the world came right over a 14-day period, you know, for the previous 10 years that he just fought and scrapped and clawed, you know, it all came right. And great example of perseverance. And yet, you know, they also raced the boat quite well. So, you know, all those things came together.
Yeah, this certainly was a huge progression. I wanted to just go back to the designs now. You mentioned these four designs, and as you say, we saw the Defender and the Challenger of Record who'd had sight of the rule before yourselves and the British team come out with let's say more similar looking boats than you and the Brits did.
Yeah.
I guess that was no surprise to us that was the case.
Well, I mean, I think it's good to see that with a little bit more time, you come up with something that's probably a little bit more clever. So you'd be disappointed if they didn't.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, but no moaning about that because that's the competition that we signed up for.
That's the way it works. Yeah.
And that's just the way it is. And so, you know, we have to, we knew we had two shots at it, and I absolutely back Marcelino and Aldolfo and our design team and boat team partners and the team that we have behind us because they're good people and they're smart and they've demonstrated over the course of a decade really of a high level of cleverness with their boats. And so yeah, it'll be a poor craftsman who blames his tools. For sure.
But I wondered if looking at them, you would, you know, if you were given a choice to swap boats with somebody, is there one of those boats that you would, that's a very obvious choice or?
I think when you look at all of them, you know, the Luna Rossa boat is quite refined. It's very nice. There's a lot of clever thinking there with the aerodynamics and how they've, you know, they were very smart in their boat. And, you know, I'm certain that in the early days, if you went off in a straight line and you never had to maneuver, there'd probably be one boat that would edge out in front of the fleet, but you know, we'll never know.
We don't know which one that is.
Yeah. We don't know. I mean, because if you look at the racing, you'd start in 45 seconds, you'd be to a boundary and you'd have to execute a foiling tack and then you'd bugger off for 90 seconds and then go around the top mark and, you know, you'll be running into boundaries. And so how do you know if that actually was going to be a race winning solution? The two could look quite different. So, but with these boats, they truly are development boats now. And so, you know, I, again, in American Magic eyes, I can see a lot of benefit to items and features that we have on Defiant, that I wouldn't expect for you to see or know about, but I can see a lot of development that will go into boat two out of boat one.
Yeah.
And so in that regards, you know, it's unfortunate that we never really got to test those things against the other teams. And at the same time, even in isolation, you can see the development happening.
Yeah. Yeah. And these boats are interesting to look at in one way. I think they're terrible to look at in another way because you don't see very much of what's going on board, but they're interesting in that this kind of trenches down down cockpit. Either side of the boat. Yeah, these cockpits, yeah. Which the because I've heard from some of the teams that they were testing basically having two sets of, you know, a helmsman on each side and basically a port team and a starboard team, and you know, I'm sure all of these things will be experimented with. But is this what we're going to see, less people running across the boat from side to side when these boats race?
Yeah, it's hard to, can't speak for the others, but on our boat, two people switch sides.
Okay.
Yeah, Dean and Goody switch sides, and the rest of us stay in our spots.
Right.
Interesting. So, yeah. And so in that regard, it's, it's not what you and I probably associate completely with. And, you know, again, it's what it is in this moment. And so our job is just to try to be a little bit better at it than the next guy.
But there is going to be this premium on being able to execute these maneuvers quickly and accurately, because as you say, you're as much as you're racing the other boats, you're racing within this confined area where there's penalties to be had from not being able to tack or... and I wondered about the dry lap thing as well. Do you think you're at the stage now where you're confident of doing, you would be confident of doing dry laps?
Yes.
That's much earlier than for the last cup, I think, right?
Yes. I wasn't there, but I think you're right. I mean, I think the guys communicated that it was, you know, even up until a couple of weeks before the Challenger series started, you know, they were still struggling with it. I would attribute the mule a lot to our development in that regard. You know, it helped. You know, the simulator, you can only do so much in a simulator. And the mule was a great tool for a lot of different areas. And just getting confident in understanding the physics behind the whole thing. It's that side of it was exceptionally beneficial. So...
How much attention do you pay to the other teams? I mean, I'm you know, we know about the spies and we know about the reconnaissance and you know, I've even heard tell that, you know, you can kind of take video of these boats sailing and use software to analyze the performance of the boat almost as if you were on the boat and you could kind of see the numbers. Is that true or have I been?
No, I mean, the recon is pretty good. You can learn a lot, and it's a mistake to not keep an eye on your competition and understand what they have and what they're doing. You know, especially right now when we're sitting here on a ship and, you know, Luna Rossa and Team New Zealand is sailing their mule and Luna Rossa is sailing their 75. It's a lot harder to stomach it because it's just a clock. It's this big invisible clock on the wall that you hear ticking.
Yeah.
And the recon though does provide a lot of input and a lot of insight. And if anything, it once we do get to line up with the other boats, it'll give us the an expectation of where our designers think they're strong and where they're weak, and what they think we'll be up against. So the knock-on effect is, and you carry that into your simulation and you work on the other teams in your simulator and see if you can mirror what their boat actually is on the water. And that'll strengthen your ability to go racing against them.
So just jumping slightly back to that question about the two boats, simulator work, is it two of your teams, two little squads of people on the simulator being two boats, or are you racing against a simulation boat when you do that?
It's our boats. Yeah.
So Dean is steering one and somebody else
I'll
is steering
one. The other. Andrew will steer one. Goody will steer one. You know, it's amazing. Even with no water, you can imagine the banter.
I'm sure. Yeah. And you're physically kind of quite close to each other in the room.
Yeah, we're literally sitting right next to each other with steering wheels.
That's
heckling
hilarious.
Each other, criticizing. That's a foul. No, it's not. As long as you're happy with it, then I guess we're okay. you know, I mean, it's all there.
And what does that room look like? Is it, I imagine it is a kind of big darkened room with a big screen, or is it?
No, I mean, we're not fancy with our setup. It was a container.
Right.
And, you know, we sit in the container and have the lights on, and, you know, generally speaking, you have the simulator going and you have a couple of the designers watching, because there'll be features in there that you'll be looking at anyway. And Coach James is in there watching and just, you know, understanding what's going on. And really, regardless of who's sailing, I mean, I enjoy watching it a lot. I enjoy watching it probably 65% of the time and then doing it 35% of the time, because it allows for both sides of it. It allows you to see the racing develop, and then also to experience it, you gain an appreciation too for how hard it is. And then you get onto the boat and you have 8 guys grinding and working and doing what they have to do. If you say it's going to be a 3-maneuver pre-start, that's a lot of work in a very short period of time for the grinders. And so understanding how you balance that energy is critical too.
And just remind me the difference on these boats to last time in terms of creating the hydraulic power. There is a difference, isn't there, between the way that we're doing it this time?
Yeah, I mean, again, I wasn't with the 2017, but there the grinders created energy for everything, for the boards, for the sails, you know, the entire boat. Here the foil is being driven by a battery.
Yeah.
And a foil cant system. And then the hydraulic power is being actuated for the other controls inside the yacht. So in that regard, we're doing less on the AC-75 with more people.
Yeah.
So the actual physical load is less than what it was on the AC-50.
Okay.
Which is great, because I'm 52 years old. So.
And once you're out and racing the boat, Terry, are you going to be fulfilling your normal tactician's strategy role? How's that going to work?
That's a great question. I don't think we know yet. I mean, I think for this boat in particular, I have to earn my spot on the boat. You know, we have some great sailors and we have some great young sailors on our team. And so, you know, we have to make sure that if we compromise the physical load that a younger, stronger person can carry, that I make up for it in a strategic, tactical sense. But the racing's quite a bit different. And for 50% of the race, my spot is on the port aft side of the boat on the back pedestal. And so for half the race, I don't see it. And so you have a tactical display, you're giving big picture strategic input to both Dean and Paul, and then and then allow them to make the right tactical decision boat on boat wise. And you know, you could see at certain times, even through the limited racing that we were doing, you can see the need to have a voice.
Yeah.
Because really you're at that point when you're on starboard, you're Dean's eyes, and you know, you're talking about what the other boat would potentially be doing. And so I'd like to think there's a need, but we have to make sure that there is a need.
Yeah.
Because the one thing you can't give up is power for the system.
Yeah. Okay. That's interesting. That's a really interesting answer. Well, you've surprised me with that answer. I think last time we spoke, we talked a lot about the raw speed of these boats, and you gave a really good description about that. I wanted to ask you about kind of the other end of the scale, because what I've been reading and what I've been hearing is just how difficult these boats are to get from standing still to transitioning up onto the foil, and they're quite vulnerable through that whole position, as far as I understand. I think Paul Goodison did a nice interview with Sailing World about this a little while ago. Can you just talk about that a little bit, and you know, how you guys are kind of...
Well, the boat is inherently unstable. And unlike the catamaran that has the two hulls, you get a lot of stability out of that platform. So this boat, with just being the monohull, and you have the one foil that's up out of the water as your source of stability. Once you're transitioning up onto the foil, once the boat's up and out of the water, it's actually quite stable. You know, that's the boat's its safest when it's hauling ass, because it's, you know, that's where it generates all the stability. So that transition up to that point, you know, you have to manage, and obviously out of the maneuvers and particularly out of the jibes, when you're searching for aero load onto the sail program, you have to manage how high you dare sail. And so in that regard, you have to be very careful in executing those maneuvers. And I would say that I don't feel that level of vulnerability on this boat. You know, we've had some good little wipeouts. We haven't tipped the thing over, thankfully. So, you know, but you can see why you would, and you can see, the level of caution, if that's the right word, that you have to take. Maybe it's practicality more than caution, but you just have to be smart in each situation. And in that regard, I think we're fortunate, because at any given time, between Dean and Paul, you know, we have two very experienced foiling sailors there. And so in that regard, we're lucky.
Yeah. Yeah. So which leads me on to my next question about what we can expect as spectators in terms of the racing. And of course we hear all the time, oh, these boats are not suitable for match racing, and it's going to be a drag race. And, you know, I just wonder whether there's any
wrong.
Yeah.
Well, I said, wrong.
I wonder if there's any validity in that. And, but I also, you know, at the end of the day, it is a match race. It's yeah. You just got to beat the other guy.
That's right. But
are there going to be points where the boats are vulnerable to, you know, they're not going to be maneuverable, and somebody can kind of dive in and give you a penalty and then take off and you never see them again?
Yeah. That's a great question. Well, if you look at 2007 in the last version of that version 5 boat, so the delta, the average delta for a race win in that regatta was 19 seconds. And in the version 5 boat, you know, call it 4 boat lengths. So that was some really good close racing. In 2013 and again in 17, the racing was won by the fastest boat. The regatta was won by clearly the fastest boat. In 13, took the one guy a little bit longer to get his act together, but in the end, the fastest boat won. And in 17, you know, they have the fastest boat won going away in a landslide. So I don't think that you're going to see the same type of match racing that we saw in 2007. I think you'll see an interaction between the boats in the pre-start. You do have this big foil sticking out of the side, and so we know that the rules are going to allow for a zone really in and around the boat, that if you infringe on that zone, one boat will get a penalty and the other won't. And, you know, so from there, it's hard to really know. I would expect that the boundary racing itself keeps the boats interacting with each other. And then once you get around the top mark, you know, one boat's probably going to be faster, and faster measured in these things. If one boat is 10% faster, or call it 5% faster, one boat's going to be going 2 knots faster. So, which will very quickly open up spacing in between the two boats. And then from there, it's about executing your maneuvers.
So I can see this will be leading into, you know, so much importance on the pre-start, so much importance on being able to tack effectively on the first upwind leg. And a little bit like I think you told me in the TP52s, there's a huge emphasis on having a good top mark rounding in those races, because that's after that, there aren't too many passing opportunities.
No, I think that's a great, you know, identifying what gates favored, identifying the long jibe out of the top mark is critical. And remembering that a boat that is in, you know, a knot more wind speed probably goes 2 knots faster. Identifying where the breeze is, you know, massively important.
Wow, this sounds like proper sailing stuff, Terry, but people tell me these boats are not sailing anymore.
Yeah, I mean, it would be a mistake to think that proper sailing, you know, it is the same discipline. It just happens at a different speed. And so you still have to do all the process of racing the boat well. You have to execute all those things accordingly. And which is the ironic part about this. I mean, if you think about, I mean, I look at it and think, the silver lining to all of us is two of our competitors, one was set up to do the GP50, and clearly he demonstrated in the first regatta that he hasn't lost a beat. Another team was set up to race in the Olympics and, you know, have a lot of great race training leading up. It's all been taken away. And so now there are four teams that are sitting there with basically a level playing field of time and development. Now I can see it's not completely level because we still have to get to New Zealand. We have to be allowed in the country. You know, there's certain things that have to happen. So it's not completely level in that regard, but that's not assigning a blame or anything. It's just kind of the nature of the beast of what we're living in right now, you know, for everybody.
Yeah. So do you think I think there was a perceived advantage to the defender, to the Kiwis having, you know, created the rule and been so familiar with it, you know, that they were X number of weeks ahead of everybody else. But do you think that's now narrowed right down, or what?
Yeah, I don't know. I never had the opportunity to see.
Yeah.
I think the mistake would be to underestimate your competition.
No, absolutely.
So we're operating with that mindset, which is, you know, it's better to keep pushing because there's so much invested in both time and resource that the mistake would be to not be pushing hard right now. And really, you know, the other silver lining probably for American Magic is the forced remote working. We've been set up like that for the last 2.5 years. It's really the only thing we knew. And so when the world was forced to hit the pause button, we never paused. We kind of just kept rolling because it's how we'd been working anyway.
And I heard you on another interview talk about the state of Rhode Island and the fact you were able to keep the boat building rolling through, which has been, I think, you know, absolutely, seems like that will be absolutely key now to you being able to go down to New Zealand.
Yeah. No, Governor Raimondo, she did a great job, and the leadership in Rhode Island did a really good job of navigating through something that, you know, a channel that nobody had ever been in before. So, but I think much like she did there, much like the Prime Minister of New Zealand has done, you know, they've applied a fair level of discipline and hit the thing hard on the head early. And, you know, you can always back your way out of that. If it's reckless at the front side, you know, it's going to be slower on the backside. So we go in baby steps.
Yeah. So update me now on where you're up to. I think you mentioned boats on ships and stuff. So
yeah,
both boats are going to New Zealand. Is that the
both
plan?
Both boats are going to New Zealand. You know, Defiance there. She's on her way there and will be, she'll be in a race, you know, she'll be in a state that after we start sailing boat two, she'd be a couple days away from being ready to go racing if we had a massive crash. But you know, much beyond that, we're using a lot of the internal pieces out of boat one and into boat two. And so, you know, you can't have, you know, outside of the foil arms, having two platforms sitting there ready to go is bloody expensive.
Yeah.
So yeah, you peel back on the one to help the other.
So then boat two is complete now in Rhode Island?
It's still being built. And but they're going at it, you know, again, they're going at a pace that's impressive to see. You know, the silver lining of a pandemic is it's forced us into a couple shifts. And so when you get into that environment, you never have a situation where you're always rolling. And so in that regard, it's really good.
So you've obviously seen the boat. You know what it looks like.
I haven't. I've seen pictures, but until the end of this month, it's a 2-week quarantine to go into Rhode Island. And so when all this came upon us, I'm dying to see it, but you know,
that must be killing you.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard because you want to go and see it. It's like, well, but you can't ask. It's irresponsible to walk into the place and not do what's been requested of every single other team member, and then to put yourself above that would be a clanger. So, we got another week here, and then we'll get in, go up and have a look. It's exciting, and it's awesome to, from my perspective, we have a lot of great people that are working and taking this project on, and it is hard because it is a lot of work, and the time component has gone from a pretty wide focus straight into a tunnel, and you can see very clearly the light at the end of that tunnel, even though the racing's still about 9 months away. So we got a lot to do between now and then.
And the deadline for that boat being completed?
We hope to have her on the ground in New Zealand a couple days into September.
Okay. And you'll fly her down?
Fly it there, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Are you guys documenting all of this campaign in some sort of video fashion? Because there's just the success of these Formula One Drive to Survive videos and stuff. It just, the stuff you're talking about just seems like it would lend itself to that.
Yeah. I'm sure we could do that better. I know we could. And I know we could. And I know we'll be criticized because we probably haven't done as well as we could have, but we've been so focused on a fast boat and winning the regatta and all the things that go into that, that any resource that we would want to give to something like that is difficult to do because you want to have a fast boat. Designers want to design, the sailors want to sail, and the videographer to document this. Who?
Yeah. Forget that guy. Yeah, I know.
But your point's not wrong. And representing the New York Yacht Club and the history of the club inside the America's Cup, I've gained a much higher level of appreciation and respect for what that actually means now that we're 2.5 years into it.
Yeah, for sure. So both boats end up down in New Zealand, and the first boat you will put on the water will be the second boat. You're not planning to rate?
We'll sail Defiant. Our plan, again, if it all goes well, we'll be sailing Defiant the third week of July in New Zealand.
Okay.
We'll be there for a couple months sailing that boat before boat two hits the water.
Gotcha. Okay. Understood. So that's, I'm interested to know what the priorities would be once you're in New Zealand. I guess you have to quarantine when you get down there.
We're still waiting for that protocol from the government. And I think but we're expecting a 14-day quarantine. We're expecting those restrictions. We have team members that are New Zealand citizens that have already gone back, and they're going through that right now. And it's been, the feedback from them has been exceptionally positive. And so we go and we'll do the necessary steps that we need to take on to be, much like we were in Pensacola, safe members of the Auckland community. And then we'll get into our jobs and we'll work on developing not only continued features that we have in Defiant, but also work on sailing on the race courses. If you just at face value take that, I always laugh because Stoltz is quick to say, we arrived in Bermuda 5 weeks before the match and we won the regatta. It's like, okay, well, just pause there and take that thought. There's 5 different race courses in New Zealand, so we need 5 weeks per race course. So
you're already out of time, right?
Exactly. That's exactly right. So in my mind, to continue to maintain the level of fairness in the competition, that's exactly what we need.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I just wonder from the spectator side, whether what you can share, do you think we will see this behind closed doors almost?
Or? I don't know. I mean, what you do know, and I don't have any knowledge of anything. So, what you do know is that the New Zealand government's invested heavily in Team New Zealand, and they've invested heavily in the infrastructure in New Zealand. And so they need to have a return on their investment. So, but through their actions of being safe and smart and leading, there might be limitations to that.
Yeah.
But, that's, That's probably for somebody else who's a fair amount smarter than me to determine where the return of investment is and what that means and looks like. But, you know, I say with all sincerity in the world that, you know, that the New Zealand government has, you know, they committed to that team even when I was part of it. And so, you know, you'd like to see them get a healthy return on their investment for what they've put into it and for the commitment really that they showed to a sailing team for the better part of 15 years.
So. Yeah. And I think fantastically important for sailing, professional sailing
yes.
in general, that the yeah. Cup goes ahead.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's schedule. Now, in that, you know, I know I'm biased in my opinion because we're the first team that is working to get there. You know, we have to, you know, it's great that we have a regatta on the books and we have something to look forward to. But as, you know, as we just discussed, if it's 5 weeks of development per course, well, then they need to allow the teams the opportunity to come in also and develop their skills on those courses for, you know, for the fairness of the competition.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, we're living in a time and unprecedented for all of us. And so, you know, at a certain point, if you just base it on the New Zealand leadership and how well they've done at handling the situation, it gives you confidence that all the decisions going forward are also going to be equally as smart. So,
yeah.
There's no reason to, in the year of 2020, there's no reason to second guess it.
Yeah.
Just, you know, much like a lot of other parts of this competition, you just take what's given and get on with it.
And as you say, you'll go virtually straight into the Challenger Selection Series, but
yeah,
that's the way it used to be. That's the way it was when you were racing most of your cups, right? The America's Cup World Series idea kind of came along a little later on, right?
Yeah, no, these pre-events started in 2007 with Alinghi and carried on in some capacity with the AC45s and then again in 2017. So, yeah, I mean, that's in 2000, we landed in July of 99 for an event that started in late November, and that thing rolled all the way through. And then again in 2003, we landed in July of 2002, and we were the last team there, and the rest of the guys had already been there training. And so, you know, you knew, at least even though there wasn't any racing, you kind of were always in the general vicinity of other teams, and so you kind of knew who was going well and who wasn't. Here it's straight into the fire, so, which is fun.
Which I think you will relish the challenge of, Terry.
Yep, absolutely.
I mean,
at the end of the day, we're all dealing with the same thing, and so that's where, that's where you have your fire suit on and away you go.
Yeah, I have to say I'm pleasantly surprised. I know this is going to go out as an audio podcast, but we're recording this and we can see each other on Zoom.
Yeah,
I thought you would be looking much more stressed and exhausted. You look relaxed and happy and. You know, I'm sure you've got the weight of the world on your shoulders. How are you coping with it from a personal point of view? Because it's a huge responsibility, right?
Yes, it is. And I have sweaty palms every day. But, you know, there's a fair amount of this that's outside of our control. And so the things that you can control, we have to the nth degree, more so than ever. I think we've been exceptionally lucky as a team to have the support of Doug DeVos and Hap Fouth and Roger Penske and the New York Yacht Club, because these guys haven't wavered once in their commitment in incredibly challenging times. And you know, over the course of this program, I can look back and see where we've made a lot of really good decisions. I can see where we've made shortcomings, and I can see where we've gotten better because of those shortcomings. So. More so than ever, I back us, and I'm confident that we have everything that we need to do to keep the ball going in the right direction. And from there, if it gets down to the end and it's on the sailors, then I am confident that more often than not, that we can do what we need to do on the day, with respect that all the other teams are very, very good as well. So, but the relaxness is comfort in those points. And at the same time, it's a very uncomfortable time because we are going into the unknown. We're taking a step where we're losing control of our equipment for a period of time without any certainty from the New Zealand government. So it's a risky decision. We don't really have any practical option to do it in the United States. And so occasionally you just have to be willing to hike a little bit harder and sail further into the corner.
I think that's a great way we should wrap it up, Terry. Terry, as always, it's a real pleasure. Fantastic insight into this campaign, which I know has a strong following, not just in the States, but you know, around the world as well, in the countries that are not represented themselves. I wish you the best. I hope we get the chance to do another podcast in maybe towards the end of the year once.
I hope we get to do it in New Zealand.
Perfect. Sounds great. Thanks a million, Terry. Right,
take care. Thank you.
Well, that's it for this episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast. Thanks again to my guest, Terry Hutchinson, for taking the time to speak to me. And thanks, as always, to all of you for listening around the world. If you're enjoying this podcast series, please, it would be great if you could take a moment to leave us a star rating and maybe even a quick review. Thanks if you can do this. We really appreciate it as it helps hugely with growing our audience. I'll be back soon with another episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast, but until then, I'll just say, sail fast, everyone.